Tell me, how did you get involved in this and with Pastor Rob?
I am actually involved as the membership coordinator for the Knights Party Crusaders Youth Corps. You know, I think it's crucial that people in my position do everything we can to educate white youth about our perspective on American history. Mm-hmm. All of our founding fathers were white. Mm-hmm. America was not established to be a melting pot.
If America wasn't established to be a melting pot, why did they bring so many black people over here with them when they established it?
They never intended them to be citizens or equals.
And now, but if they hadn't brought us in the first place, you would have never had this problem.
I agree, and I wish that my ancestors had picked their own cotton.
You and me both, sir. Right. That we can agree on.
And yeah. So the only way to undo that original sin mm-hmm. is repatriation.
So does that mean sending the black people back to Africa?
If they're not content or we can't find a peaceable geographical separation here in the United States, that might be an option.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm up here and I see this beautiful playground. And I think about the fact that my daughter, if she was with me, would like to play on this playground. Would that be acceptable?
Well, you know, there are millions of majority black neighborhoods in the United States mm-hmm. that my daughter could not play in today. Because of the violence, because of the drugs, because of the color of her skin. So, no, sometimes it's better for people to have their own places to play.
All right. What do they have to say about my friends on the Harrison Task Force on Race Relations?
What they're trying to do is forcibly diversify our community. And we don't think, and a lot of people in the Harrison community don't think, that making Harrison more like West Africa is an improvement.
Wouldn't Harrison have to go pretty far to be more like West Africa? Like when I drive into town and I see that sign, anti-racism equals anti-white, it makes me feel like as a guy who's not from this community, driving in this community, I should probably drive through this community.
So. When I say racist, mm-hmm. can you honestly tell me that you don't see a white person?
I can honestly tell you that.
Really?
I have black relatives who are racist.
Well, then, so, then I would yeah. say that you're probably in the minority of African Americans, because when people think of racism, they have been programmed to think of white people. So therefore, anti-racism really is anti-white.
You are listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system. RadioAryan.com.
Can you hear the student band? I think they're getting out of hand. Well, you know what happened to those who complain. We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right. Cause the fireworks aren't to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We're set a wedding full of clowns. And we'll kick them while they're down. Give the banks control, cause they are friends to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America. The best idea since democracy.
Hello and welcome once again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, to the Rope Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, brought to you right here on RadioAryan.com. The Rope Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast, covers news, entertainment, and political commentary from a perspective just to the right of Julius Streicher, one that you will not hear anywhere else. This is the podcast for the second week of November 2017. As we get closer to Memorial Day on the 11th, we'll talk for a little bit about the origin of Memorial Day with the armistice ending the First World War. We'll also talk about the Muslim terrorist attack in New York, as well as, of course, what's on many of our minds, the church shooting in Texas. But let's start by telling you about a coming meeting, December the 2nd, in Central Arkansas. On 12-2, we'll have the next official Shieldwall Network meeting in Central Arkansas. And if you'd like to get more information about how you can attend, if you're in the state or in adjoining state or within driving distance, then you can contact me, Billy Roper, at roper_billy@yahoo.com to get more details and information and to RSVP so we can plan for how many people will be attending. Now, at this next official Shieldwall Network meeting will be bringing three new Phalanx members into the Shawal Network Phalanx, giving them their patches and administering their oaths and signing them up for the defensive arm of the Shieldwall Network, the Phalanx. We'll also be bringing in some new Shieldwall Network affiliates and filling out and signing Christmas cards to be sent to imprisoned white inmates as well as Jacob Goodwin, our Shieldwall Network Phalanx member who still languishes in the Lone Oak County, Arkansas jail, awaiting extradition to Virginia. We've been successful so far through his attorneys and through our emails and our phone calls and our faxes and our social media posts in delaying the extradition of Jacob to the kangaroo court waiting for him in Charlottesville, Virginia. We don't anticipate that we'll be able to forestall the extradition forever, but we do hope that we can delay it because, in our view, and in the views of his parents, the longer that Jacob is able to remain in Arkansas, close to his friends and family, the better. He's probably going to face a very hard time in Virginia, as those who have already been extradited there have already found out. They've also been denied bond or being held without any consideration of habeas corpus in comparison to the two black defendants, both of whom have been charged and then immediately released, despite the fact that they're both former convicted felons, and Jacob Goodwin has never had so much as a traffic ticket on his record. We all know that the system is corrupt. If we needed any further reminder, it's obviously right in front of us as we see the collusion between the state and federal and local governments against white people going on still in Charlottesville and against the defendants who stood up for free speech August the 12th there. So we're hopeful that those of you who have not yet had an opportunity to will go to change.org and will sign the petition to ask Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson to deny or delay the extradition of Jacob Goodwin to Charlottesville, Virginia. We also ask that you will go to goifundme.com or to fundedjustice.com and to make a contribution to help Jacob's parents with his legal defense. And if you have the time, please forward the petition and the open letter that was written to Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson to everyone on your email and social media list so we can get more and more people involved and, most importantly, make more people aware of the case, because what our enemies want to do, in addition to silencing us, is to be able to sweep this whole situation under the rug. They want to try to put these guys away without any public discussion of what they're charged with or the fact that they were defending themselves. This last week, we have really some bombshell news that I would really love to share with you. There's nothing that would make me happier than to be able to tell you what we've discovered as far as Jacob's case. We think that it will be extremely helpful in his defense. As a matter of fact, it may even lead to the charges against him being dropped ultimately. We have discovered the identity of the person who physically attacked Jacob from behind, a sucker punch blindsided after the fight was over when Jacob was peacefully walking away. We have video evidence showing the identity of the person who attacked Jacob from behind after the fight was over. And we have their name and their address and their criminal record and their social media contact. We're not going to share that person's name right now because I don't want to potentially warn him, scare him off, give him the opportunity to run. I don't want to be responsible for him getting away from justice. I don't want to show all of our cards right now. So I'm not going to be the one to publicly air the name of the person who attacked Jacob Goodwin after the fight was over from behind in a sucker punch. But we do have that name, and it will come out very soon. So keep your ears posted for that. We do think that it will help the case of all the defendants, but especially Jacob Goodwin, when charges are filed against that attacker from August the 12th in Charlottesville. Now, we have to talk about the Muslim truck terror attack in New York City, where this Uzbekistan-born diversity visa winner came into the United States, got a driver's license in Florida, became a driver for Uber, and rented a Home Depot flatbed truck, drove it into bicycle pedestrian path in lower Manhattan, and killed innocent civilians there, including school children. Now, what we know so far is that he has claimed allegiance to ISIS. He asked that an ISIS flag be hung in his hospital bed because he was eventually shot and apprehended by police. We also know that ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack and that he had left a note in the truck that he had rented praising ISIS. So this was certainly a terror attack. It was an Islamic terror attack. Liberals were quick to try to ban flatbed pickup trucks, or saying that flatbed pickup trucks should be restricted, that you had to have a special license to rent a pickup truck, or that pickup trucks should not be allowed in cities. You can own a pickup truck, but you can't drive one. Right. No, they didn't, of course, because that would have shown their hypocrisy when it comes to gun control, as we'll talk about again in the Texas case in just a moment. But liberals were very quick to say that, oh, this was just an isolated incident. This was a lone wolf. He was radicalized online. There's no connection to the broader Muslim community. It would be wrong to paint in too broad a brush and to say that all Muslims are terrorists or potential terrorists. That would be hateful and bigoted. But of course, they're quick to attack all whites as being racist and white supremacists and Nazis who want to kill 6 billion Jews every time that someone gets called nigger. We know that the liberals are in denial. Those who are not in denial are simply dishonest. So we don't have to pick apart their case or their argument. But the takeaway from the New York Muslim truck attack is that this guy was a Muslim. He was the winner of something called the diversity visa, and we should probably talk about that for just a minute. The diversity visa was established and pushed by New York Jewish Senator Chuck Schumer. Now, Chuck Schumer is an anti-white, anti-gun, left-wing liberal Jew, very outspoken, very smarmy, and if you see a side profile of the guy, he looks like a caricature, the merchant. Chuck Schumer actually was elected to Congress first before he was elected to the U.S. Senate. And as he rose up through the ranks, 1983, I believe, he entered Congress. In 1989, he actually worked with liberals from both parties to pass the Diversity Visa Act. And basically what this Diversity Visa Law does is it allows 50,000, actually more like 55,000, 55,000 non-white immigrants per year to come into the United States from countries that don't give visas to people who have relatives here. In other words, from third world countries where people don't normally immigrate from. In this case, Uzbekistan. Now, whether or not the terrorist got to bring his own goat from Uzbekistan or he had to divorce her and get a new wife once he got here is unclear. But Charles Schumer worked to pass this literal diversity visa program. That's what it's called. And then he was elected to the U.S. Senate. Now, interestingly enough, Schumer occupies the same seat from New York in the U.S. Senate that was held by Seller, another Jew, in 1965 when Seller worked to propose and promote and to pass the 1965 Hart-Seller Immigration Act, which opened the U.S. borders to non-white immigration from all over the world and really began what's called chain immigration, where one immigrant ends up bringing in their entire family, their entire village. And so one immigrant being allowed in results in 100 immigrants being here. So the 1965 Immigration Act, or the Hart-Seller Act as it was called, because they were the authors of it, were actually promoted by Jews and liberal Jewish supporters in the U.S. Senate, but specifically by Hart-Seller. That's why it's important to keep track of their sins against our people, so that when the day of reckoning comes, they'll be called to pay for them. So Charles Schumer, the Jew from New York, U.S. Senator, was responsible for this diversity visa program, which brought in this Muslim who carried out the truck terror attack in New York this last week. Now, usually here in the United States, the Jews use Mexicans and Central Americans because they're geographically closer and just as a tool of proximity, easier for them to reach. They use Mexicans and Central Americans and other mestizos to flood America with non-whites. In Europe, they typically use Muslims because Muslims are more geographically accessible to Europe for the Jews to use. And ironically, the Muslimification of Europe, the Islamification of many of the European cities that formerly were all white, has led to an increase in anti-Semitism because Muslims, by their nature and their experience, are more anti-Semitic, more opposed to Jewish power and hegemony than white Europeans are. So the Jews who promoted bringing non-white Muslims into Europe to brown Europe are now being forced to make aliyah and to flee Europe back to Israel, which is a good thing, but it shouldn't require the Islamification of Europe or the browning of the continent to occur. We've done it 109 times before on our own. We should be able to clean up our own mess without having the Muslims come in. There's interesting discussion on the Stormfront radio program a few days ago about this very process. And Dr. Patrick Slattery said that we need to be careful that the Muslims coming into European countries did not gain control of the militaries and the nuclear arsenals of these European countries, because that would be horrible for Muslims to have control over these nuclear weapons. And Father Francis very quickly and adroitly quipped that yes, that would be horrible for the Jews, because if Muslims got control of the nuclear arsenals of European nations, then they'd probably target those missiles on Israel. And the Israelis, our greatest allies, our most loyal friends, would certainly hate that. That would be another irony, wouldn't it? But back to New York. This diversity visa program, which was sponsored and pushed by Jewish New York Senator Chuck Schumer, brings 55,000 non-whites from the third world into the United States every year, practically unvetted. And now we see the result of a program which specifically, by its very title, is aimed at destroying the homogeneous white majority in the United States of America. And whether or not Trump legitimately works to erase this program, to do away with it, I don't know. And I do know that outgoing Senator Jeff Flake from Arizona, who discovered that he was not going to be able to win his reelection bid next year, so he decided that he would retire, is a rhino. He's a lefty liberal, regardless of his political affiliation in terms of party. He's a Republican in name only. And he was quick to say that people should not blame the diversity visa program because Charles Schumer worked to do away with it when the Gang of Eight had their meeting. And he knew because he was there. Well, I'm sure that he was there. The Gang of Eight are a group of liberal senators from both sides of the aisle, Republican and Democrat, who basically want to open America's borders and influx of non-white immigrants to be welcomed in and to destroy our racial fabric as a nation. The Gang of Eight includes McCain, John McCain. So Jeff Flake and John McCain, both rhinos from Arizona, both indicating by their presence that Arizona is being conquered through La Reconquista, because no senator, no congressman, no statewide elected official from Arizona who wanted to defend our borders or to preserve our nation could be elected anymore in Arizona. They have far too many Hispanics there. And that's part of the process I talk about in my book, The Bulk. As Hispanics become a majority in these border states and in the Southwest at large, ultimately, those states are, through elections, through legal means, through the ballot box, becoming de facto parts of Mexico. And we see that coming to fruition as, for example, California is now a sanctuary state, where they've already told the federal government, we're not going to endorse or enforce any federal immigration laws. So that's what really has led to Flake and McCain getting entrenched in Arizona, and part of the backlash after Trump's election is leading to a more conservative Republican probably replacing Jeff Flake. And he saw that train coming down the tracks at him, so he decided to retire. On the way out, he tries to cover for himself and for McCain and for Chuck Schumer and this diversity visa program, which so many people are now aware of that it's probably dead in the water. And that's a good thing. And that's how we really shine a light on these cockroaches and defeat their treason by making people aware of what they've actually done and what they are doing. So the takeaway from the Muslim truck attack, the terrorist act in Lower Manhattan, New York this last week, is that diversity indeed equals white genocide. Diversity creates chaos and violence and terrorism. Importing Muslims makes America more like the violent Middle East. Importing Muslims makes America a target for terrorism, both homegrown and from an international aspect. So diversity, once again, is shown to the whole American public as being a bad thing, a negative thing. And all except for the most brainwashed liberals saw this. And the backlash against the very idea of a diversity visa program, not based on merit, but based on their origin, their non-white origin, was attacked almost across the aisle, really. Now, in addition to the terror attack in New York by this Muslim truck rental, we had, on the 4th, these much-ballyhooed anticipated protests by Antifa and Anonymous and Black Lives Matter. And it was actually pushed by the Resist Fascism organization that was the mask of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And I wrote about this extensively in the Roper Report's blog, which you can find by going to theroperreportsite.wordpress.com or to whitenationalist.com and to look up what I wrote. And I anticipated that it would not be as exciting or as thrilling or as exhilarating as people thought. I was hopeful. You know, I'm always optimistic. I'm always thinking that I'm going to wake up one morning and the day of the rope will have begun. And it will be time for us to make our enemies pay for everything they've done over the last century. I'm always really optimistic and hopeful that, you know, one day the lights are going to go out and not come back on, and we're going to know what time it is, and then we're going to let them know what time it is, and we're going to communicate with them once and for all, in a manner which they will not find at all ambiguous. I'm always hopeful and optimistic that I will get to see that happen, that I'll get to play a role in that in my lifetime, because like Thomas Paine said, when they had funded the American Revolution and gotten it paid for and kicking it off, he was asked by someone, "Don't you love peace?" Or actually a Quaker, a pacifist, asked him, "Don't you love peace?" He said, "I do love peace, but if we must have war, then let it be in my time so that my children can have peace." And I feel the same way. I'd like to go ahead and get it done. I've actually and literally, don't mind telling you, my dear listeners, that I've been waiting on it for my whole life. I've been working towards it, the day of the rope, Rahoa, for my whole life. Been anticipating it, and I hope that it happens where I can get a few shots in, hypothetically speaking, in an alliterative sense, of course. So we all anticipate that this is coming. We all thought that it might kick off as they had promised on November the 4th. They said they're going to hold protests nonstop until they either got Trump and Pence out of office through a coup d'etat or actually kicked off a civil war and revolution. Well, it kind of fizzled. I think that the Texas church shooting may be a result of that. This guy seems to be Antifa. This Devin Patrick Kelly is a supporter of social justice and civil rights causes. He is in mixed race relationships. He is an atheist and voted for Bernie Sanders. So perhaps he was inspired by the 4th and their call for a coup d'etat or a civil war. In actuality, we saw basically the same leftists in the same liberal cities, which you should literally learn from this, white folks, where not to live. If you live in Portland or Seattle or Philadelphia or New York or Chicago or Atlanta, it's time to move. Because whether it happens now or on Cinco de Mayo next year or 5 years from now, the balkanization of America is inevitable. And when that happens, these places where leftists can put 1,000 or 5,000 people in the streets are not going to be very pleasant to live. Not just because they have a lot of minorities, not just because leftists live there, but because those cities are going to be bloodbath. They're going to be carnal houses. And those that are able to crack down and establish a totalitarian order, an autocracy, to hold things together are going to be communist. They already are. So please look at where Antifa has their strength and decide not to raise your children there. It's very basic. It's what I talk about throughout the Balk. We need to establish the front lines ourselves by voting with our feet and moving to what will become New America. To not try to stand as an island or a small white ethnic enclave in majority non-white area. What we learned on November the 4th, basically, was that, yeah, the left was selling wolf tickets, but it's not as they now claim because they wanted to cry wolf and to provoke a reaction from us. It's because they actually were, I believe, probing to see what the reaction would be to an extent, but they weren't trying to provoke a reaction from us because they know that if they actually provoke a reaction from us, they will lose. In their hearts, they know that every time there's a protest or a demonstration or a rally, those police are there to protect them, and certainly not there to protect us. They know that if we ever had a massive protest or rally or demonstration, regardless of the numbers on either side, if the police just went home and did not have any consequences for our actions, that by sundown there would not be a single commie left standing. They recognize that. Now, just like in New York, where, of course, they don't have any Second Amendment rights, they have complete full gun control laws, and the Muslim terrorist, the truck renter, got out of the truck after he had been stopped by running into so many vehicles that his truck failed to function. He was not able to go to the Brooklyn Bridge to continue his attacks as he planned on. He got out of the truck with a BB gun and an airsoft gun and walked around in circles until the police actually showed up, who had very real guns and shot him down. Didn't kill him, unfortunately, yet, but shot him down with their very real guns because his BB guns and his airsoft guns didn't work so well. Just like these Antifa that had that rally in Texas, the John Brown Gun Club, when they stood around having their protest, their armed protest, with their airsoft guns, including some with little orange tips. And they wanted to intimidate and frighten white nationalists. This civil war that is coming is going to be waged between two very different sides. On one side, you have people like me, who've been really dreaming about the day of the rope in Rahoa for our entire lives, and just chomping at the bit, tingling in anticipation, to quote myself. And then on the other side, these Antifa, these faggots. On one side, people like me who have stockpiled over a trillion rounds of ammunition. On the other side, people that don't even know what bathroom to use. So I think that they want to push it so far, but not to get out of control, because ultimately they are very afraid of us. They know very much what would happen if the gloves came off completely. And so November the 4th was really much ado about nothing. It was not very exciting, kind of boring. Hopefully they can do better. If not, then maybe we'll just have to show them how it's done. Now, coming up soon, we're going to have some reminder ribbons. They're being produced right now by Melissa Dennis of the Noble Breed Kindred out in California. And these reminder ribbons will be for Jacob Goodwin's Legal Defense Fund. They're very nice. They say, Jacob Goodwin, political prisoner, and they are red, white, and blue, with the Shield Wall Network symbol on it. You can actually see pictures of these Jacob Goodwin memorial ribbons at the Rope Report website at whitenationalist.com. They'll be available for $25 each for a donation to Jacob Goodwin's Legal Defense Fund. We'll let you know here on the Rope Report as soon as they're available for order. From P.O. Box 1937, Mountain View, Arkansas, 72560. Now, while I'm giving out that address, let me mention that we have, as we do every year, coming up again this year, the Cover Our People with Love White Family Drive. Now, the Cover Our People with Love is a pro-white charity which is led by my wife, Tina Roper. And just to give some kudos, some appreciation out to my wife, she literally, every day of her life, despite bad shoulder pain from a previous surgery and injury of her right shoulder. Every day, she works hard making new baby blankets and quilts and crocheting hats and scarves and ear covers and gloves and booties for white children, infants and toddlers, newborns, as well as white children who've been taken away from neglectful and abusive homes. We all know what the opioid epidemic has done to our people and how it's broken up so many families and left so many children without parents, either because their parents have overdosed and died or because their parents are in jail. And so a lot of these white children are entering foster homes, and they have literally nothing. The clothes on their back and maybe what they can stuff into a backpack. And when they're so vulnerable, when they're so lost and alone and sad, being told that people care about them, that their own people care about them, and just given something that belongs specifically and solely to them when really nothing else does, even if it's a quilt or a blanket, is a great comfort to these white kids. My wife, Tina Roper, runs the Cover Our People With Love pro-white charity. And each year, we hold our White Family Drive, which is designed to allow our listeners to the Roper Report and those who view and read the articles on the Roper Report website to get in touch with us to nominate white families who are in need this holiday season. Now, whether it's a white child who might just need a quilt or a blanket, or if it's a white family, a couple that's having babies and need to have baby blankets or hoodies or gloves or scarves or ear warmers or hats, then let us know. Write to us at the Cover Our People With Love charity, P.O. Box 1937, Mountain View, Arkansas, 72560. Or you can just email me at roper_billy@yahoo.com and nominate a needy white family. You can help nominate them anonymously. If your family needs help, you can ask for it. Please don't be shy. Don't be embarrassed. Don't be ashamed. We are here to help our people. All of us should be here to help our people. That's what National Socialism is all about. That's what having a white community is all about. So one of the main projects of the Shield Wall Network is our Cover Our People With Love pro-white charity. And my wife, Tina, puts a lot of effort. As I said, literally every day of her life, hours upon hours, she makes quilts and blankets and has donated hundreds of them over the last 2 years to charities and to individuals. And she's donated dozens of them just over the last couple of months. As things get closer to Christmas, winter coming in, colder weather, the need will be greater. And so if you do have any yarn or quilting material, fabric that you could donate, you can mail them to her at P.O. Box 1937, Mountain View, Arkansas, 72560, to help out with the Cover Our People With Love pro-white charity. And anything you can help with would certainly be greatly appreciated so that you can help us help our people with the Cover Our People With Love white family drive for the winter and Christmas of 2017. Now, I have to speak briefly about something that is somewhat controversial. It will upset some people that I'm being divisive, but I think that it's worth mentioning so that I can express my view and clarify it. So I'll bring that to you right after this break. Oy vey, oy vey, oy vey, oy vey. Well, I really try to avoid controversy and drama and infighting when I can. I know that I take some very hard stands. I draw some very distinct red lines. And when people cross those lines and I disagree with them, I let people know. I believe that it's important that we stand to principle and that we establish certain codes of conduct. I believe that we need to establish these codes of conduct so that everyone is clear on what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And this is true in the white nationalist movement as well as it is true in our daily personal lives as well. People have to know what you stand for. They have to know what you're all about. If they don't know who you are and what you believe and what you stand for, then there's no point in calling yourself a white nationalist or calling yourself a person of faith. If they don't know what you believe, or if they have to guess, then probably you're not strong enough in your beliefs. That's my view. Now, when it comes to faith, religious views, personal faith is just that. It's something that's very subjective, and I, in the Shieldwall Network, of course, always leave personal faith up to the individual. I don't try to dictate to my friends what God they should worship even, much less how they should worship Him. But I do try to serve as an example, and through my testimony and through my witness, discuss my own Christian identity views to them, because I feel it's my responsibility to try to explain Christian identity to my friends, and literally, I believe it's my duty to, as best as I can without alienating them, to try to witness to them and to try to bring my non-Christian views to Christ. I'll say that up front. I don't mind admitting it. I don't want to alienate them. I try not to be offensive to them, but it's my responsibility to try to bring our people back to their faith. That's part of my job as a Christian identist. Now, I will not exclude someone from my friendship if they are not yet of our faith, but I will try to serve as an example to bring them to that faith. And within the Christian community, those who are already Christians, I likewise believe that we all, as Christians, have a responsibility, as told to us by Scripture, by the Lord, to actually correct our fellow Christians when we find, as we believe, that they are in error, that they, through our judgment, have gotten off the path. And so I have, over the last week, had a discussion with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. Dr. Johnson is a very intelligent, articulate, and well-educated Orthodox Christian priest and theologian. He has a wonderful program on the Radio Arian channel, and his Orthodox Christianity, like my Christian identity faith, colors much of his beliefs. His last podcast was on racial intermarriage in the Bible. Now, to let everyone know that my discussion with Dr. Johnson did not just come out of the blue, I was not trying to pick a fight. I actually have been discussing this with him privately through email a few times before. I had asked him some rather pointed questions about his view, and by extension, because I take him at his word that he's accurately representing Orthodox Christianity, the Orthodox Christian view of race mixing and interracial relationships, and specifically whether or not, in his view, and in the view of Orthodox Christianity, race mixing is in fact a sin or not. Now, you can read his words for yourself. You can listen to his podcast for yourself on RadioArian.com. But Dr. Johnson basically said that race mixing was not a good idea, but it was not a sin. And I countered by saying that he is incorrect in his position that in the Bible, race is something that is not held as separate from faith and culture, because his defense was that since the Israelites did not have an idea of race in a genetic term, like we think of it, to the Israelites, he said, race was a part of their faith and their culture, then whenever there are admonitions against race mixing, they're really trying to preserve their faith and their culture more than their actual genetic ancestry, their race. I pointed out to him that there were several examples which refute that position, beginning in Genesis. Genesis chapter 5, when God says that this is the book of the generations of Adam, and that Hebrew word generations means race. Now, obviously, that was not an expression of Adam's culture or his faith, but rather his bloodline, his ancestry, his race. And then further on in Genesis, long before Abraham and Jacob, Israel, his grandson, were born, the founders of the Israelite people, Noah was saved by God from the flood because, specifically it says, because Noah was pure in his generations. He was racially pure. That was God's judgment, not based on Noah's culture or his religion, but rather on his race. And then further on, in Exodus, the next book of the Bible, the Pentateuch, Moses, as a child, was left by his mom in a basket woven of reeds so that Pharaoh's daughter, according to God's plan, could rescue the crying baby and take the baby into the house of Pharaoh with her, and then raise that child in Pharaoh's house to become a man of power. Now, when Moses was being raised as an Egyptian in the house of Pharaoh, he was not aware of his Israeli culture or his Israeli faith, but when he became aware of his Israeli race, his genetic kinship to the Israelites who were in bondage in Egypt. That's when he rebelled and joined his people and led them out of Egypt towards the Promised Land, crossing the Red Sea and all that, remember? So, once again, Moses was motivated not by his culture or his faith, but by his race. And then further on, you know, even in the New Testament, well, we could talk about in the Old Testament that Ruth was an Israelite woman by race, but she lived in the land of the Moabites and practiced their culture and their religion. But because she was an Israelite by race, she was redeemed, brought back into the Israelite nation by a kinsman redeemer, a man of her race. And, you know, Rahab the harlot, well, whether she was a harlot or not, she was an Israelite woman by ancestry, even though she lived among the Canaanites and practiced their religion and their culture. So she was saved from the destruction of the city because of her ancestry, not her faith. And then moving forward to the New Testament, you know, Jesus himself said many times in Matthew 15:24, he said, "I have come only to save the lost sheep of the house of Israel." He did not come to save sheep in other pastures or other flocks in that pasture. He did not come to save people who practiced a certain faith or people who were members of a certain culture. He came specifically, he said, his own words, Matthew 15:24, I encourage you to read it. He came to save the lost sheep, only the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And his parable about the Samaritans, another indication that Jesus cared about race more than he did religion. The Samaritans were Israelites who had, because, you know, of different timing, that they had not taken part in the first enslavement and captivity when the Israelites then returned. The Samaritans had become heretics and did not practice the Israelite faith according to the strict bylaws that the other Israelites did. And so they were religious heretics, but they were, by ancestry, Israelites. And so with the parable of the Good Samaritan, Jesus teaches us that our racial connection is more important than our specific theological connection. And today, in modern terms, you can think about it, you know, comparing, for example, Orthodox Christians and Christian Identists, or Catholics or Protestants. But Jesus, over and over again, made it clear that, to him, it was about race more than faith and culture. Now, obviously, you know, you have to have your faith as well to be a fully informed and blossomed Christian Identist. But the Bible is full of admonition specifically against race mixing, and it is indeed, according to Scripture, a sin. If nothing else, look at the Ten Commandments. There are two of the Ten Commandments that actually directly address human relations on an intimate form. Now, one of them says, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." That word adultery still means, to adulterate something, means to mix it. Another of the Ten Commandments says that you're not supposed to covet your neighbor's wife. Your neighbor means your kinsman, to someone you're racially related to. So you're not supposed to covet your neighbor's wife or your neighbor's maidservant. So that is the commandment that covers, you know, sex outside of wedlock, cheating. Adultery means race mixing. So if it's one of the Ten Commandments, and, you know, there's no reason to have a redundant commandment covering two things. If it's one of the Ten Commandments, then obviously race mixing is indeed a sin. Dr. Johnson responded by saying that he agreed that I was correct about the Samaritans, and that, you know, maybe if a nation like in Europe is being invaded by non-whites, that then race mixing could be considered wrong. I said, you know, Dr. Johnson, frankly, my God, the God that I worship, is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. He is the same yesterday and today and tomorrow. His truth is not subjective. It's not situational ethics that frame the Almighty's ethical system or what he says is a sin or not. What was a sin when he wrote it 3,000 years ago is a sin today, and race mixing is a sin according to Scripture. And then he said something that troubled me. He said that there were some complementary races that could race mix without harm, and that, for example, Greeks and Turks could race mix without harm, and that Russians and Tartars, who are Asians, could race mix without harm, but blacks and whites could not. And I again responded to him that, to me, there's not much of a difference. It's a sliding scale, of course, but I do not believe that non-whites of any kind should be considered a complementary race to whites, and we should accept people race mixing with Asians or with Turks, Tartars, as being complementary. Whites should be with whites. And, of course, as a Christian Identist, I don't even believe that non-whites have souls. So They're not capable of redemption and don't need salvation any more than any other animal does. So Dr. Johnson and I have this ongoing debate on the Radio Aryan page for his broadcast about race mixing. And I presented, I feel, the Christian identity response to his Orthodox Christianity position on race mixing. Basically, it comes down to the point that Orthodox Christianity does not believe that race mixing is a sin, and Christian identity and myself, well, we do. So people can read that for themselves and decide, you know, I'm not misrepresenting it. I'm trying to quote him as much as my memory serves verbatim, but, if my memory differs, then you can read his own words and hear his own voice for himself as he represents that difference. Now, I think it matters because if Orthodox Christianity believes that race mixing is not a sin, that's just maybe a bad idea, then it's no different from any mainstream Judaized church, which led us down the slippery slope to where we are today with most Judaized churches being anti-racist. Because in 1872, literally over a century ago, the Orthodox Church got together, had a synod, and agreed that racism and bigotry was wrong, that discrimination was wrong. And they passed statements, public statements against it. The Orthodox Christian Church is publicly and officially opposed to racism and bigotry. They made a big statement after Charlottesville condemning white nationalism and the alt-right. So they have been anti-racist for many more decades longer than the most cucked Judaized Protestant Christian churches are or have been today. So that was my clarification of the exchange between myself and Dr. Johnson. I have a lot of respect for him. Obviously, he's a very intelligent, articulate, and well-researched and well-spoken theologian, a man worthy of your reading and your listening. But this is a very deep gulf between our faiths. And it's why I have serious questions about Orthodox Christianity as a whole. Because I feel that ultimately what it comes down to is Orthodox Christianity is predominantly white at this time only because of an accident of geographic proximity. The only reason that it has remained white for as long as it has is because in Eastern Europe, where it was dominant after the fall of the Byzantine Empire, Orthodox Christianity was not subject to invasion by Mexicans or by blacks or by even Muslims. As a matter of fact, Eastern Europe is still one of the whitest regions because it's geographically inaccessible to non-white regions. And so, again, I feel like Orthodox Christianity is not predominantly white based on any principle, but rather on an accident of geographic proximity. And now that that geographic proximity has not been maintained, since there's no principle maintaining Orthodox Christianity as being anything white, it won't remain white. As a matter of fact, as I said, and as can be proven through just a minute or two of research on the Google monster, Orthodox Christianity is now adamantly anti-racist. And in my book, Anti-Racist, whether it's Orthodox Christianity or the Southern Baptist Convention, is anti-white.
With me here right now is Johnny Langendorf. He was driving past the church when he saw the shooting. And Johnny, can you tell me what happened next?
I pulled up to the intersection where the shooting happened, and I saw two men exchanging gunfire, the other being a citizen of the community. And the shooter of the church had taken off, fled in his vehicle, and the other gentleman came and he said we needed to pursue him, that he just shot up the church. And so that's what I did. I just acted and got him off the road. And
okay. All right, Johnny, it sounds like we may be having a little bit of a technical difficulty. I'm going to try to switch mics here. All right, Johnny, so could you tell me again, you said that you heard you saw the two men exchanging gunfire. Correct. And then one of the men, someone you recognized, jumped in the car?
No, I didn't know him at all. I didn't recognize him. He just was a member of the community. And whenever he came to my vehicle in distress and with his weapon, he explained very quickly what happened. Mm-hmm. And he got in the truck, and I knew that it was just time to...
It was time to go.
Yes, sir.
All right, so tell me about that. Tell me about following this guy. Was it high speed? Was he driving normally all over the place? What was it like?
No, sir. He got a little bit of a jump on us. And so we were doing about 95 down 539. Going around traffic and everything, and Eventually, he came to kind of a slowdown, and after that, we got within just a few feet of him, and then he got off the road.
How did that happen? Did you guys bump him, or did he lose control by himself?
He just lost control, and then that's whenever I put the vehicle in park, because I was still on the phone with dispatch, and the other gentleman jumped out and had his rifle drawn on him, and he didn't move after that.
Okay, so I understand you guys called police as you were chasing him.
Yes.
Now, did you lead them to that point? Did they meet you there? Or
no, we led them to there. He was headed northbound on 539, and everybody else was headed to the church. All the officers were responding to the church.
So how long before police arrived at that scene?
From the time we actually stopped, it was about 5 minutes, 5 to 7 minutes.
And so the neighbor just kept his gun trained on him for that long?
Yes, sir.
All right. Was the man moving? Was he injured?
No, I don't know. We didn't get close enough.
So what next? What happened once the police arrived?
Just the police arrived and they pushed us back and then they took care of the rest. I didn't see anything after that.
All right, Johnny. What was going through your mind during this chase? I mean, you're chasing a shooter. You've heard he's just shot up a church in your hometown. What's going through your mind?
Try and get him. To get him apprehended or whatever needed to happen. I mean, it was strictly just acting on what the right thing to do was.
Thank you very much, Johnny Langendorf. Again, this is Johnny Langendorf. He pursued after the shooter in his truck. Once he saw the shooter and a neighbor exchanging gunfire, the shooter, as we have heard, has been confirmed dead.
Now, we have just a few minutes left. I want to talk about this Texas church shooting. The takeaway from it. Obviously, Devin Patrick Kelly said on his social media that he supported civil rights causes. He supported social justice causes. He said that he voted for Bernie Sanders. He said that, of course, he's in a mixed race relationship. So you can look at his pictures and see that on his Facebook. He said that he literally is an atheist and argued on Facebook and on other social media platforms against believers in support of atheism. He said that he hated Christians because they were so conservative. And whether or not he was directly acting in response to the November the 4th uprising call, or whether he was actually an independent social justice warrior and self-proclaimed, let's call them lone wolf Antifas. So whether he was a lone wolf Antifa and decided to walk into this Texas church, which from what I've seen, I've not seen any non-white victims. From what I've seen, it was an entirely white church. In any event, he walked in and started shooting. And fortunately, what happened is that two white males heard the shooting, came in opposition to Devin Patrick Kelly. One of them was armed with a shotgun and shot him, and another was armed with a rifle. They fortunately wounded him there at the church, caused him to drop his rifle. And then he got to his truck, started trying to drive away, badly wounded. They jumped in their truck and pursued him 10 miles until he bled out, until he was able to be ran off the road by them and died within minutes. Now, think about this. The liberals, the left, are trying to use this as another excuse to call for more gun control. Devin Patrick Kelly was dishonorably discharged from the United States Air Force for felony, which means that legally he could not own a firearm, could not own, according to Texas state law, anything with a trigger mechanism. So it was illegal for him to have the firearm that he used already. Apparently, that law did not stop him. Who'd have thunk it? Wow, right? Amazing. So, as a dishonorably discharged, convicted felon, Devin Patrick Kelly was already breaking the law by having a firearm when he went to the church. It's illegal in Texas law to carry a firearm in a church. Strike two. Apparently, that law did not stop him from walking through the doors and starting to shoot people either. As a matter of fact, had there been armed people in that church, then maybe more lives would have been saved. As a matter of fact, when that Sudanese refugee immigrant in Antioch, Tennessee, who'd been dumped there by the federal government to try to destroy the white Middle Tennessee communities, walked into a church there and opened fire. It was an armed Congregationalist, a white man, who was able to stop the carnage before Moore died. That happened just a couple of weeks ago, but you still don't hear any of that discussed in the news, even though it was one of the core reasons for the White Lives Matter demonstration in Shelbyville, Tennessee, which was so successful last weekend. Now, in Texas, he was not supposed to have a firearm because he was a dishonorably discharged military veteran. He broke the law by carrying a firearm into the church, and he was obviously anti-Christian and a social justice warrior, race mixer. So more gun control laws would not have stopped him. He was already breaking two of them. It was two white men, armed, who confronted him at the church, shot and wounded him, and then pursued him to his death before law enforcement could arrive. This shows the truth of the Texas shooting. The problem is not guns. The problem is mentally ill anti-whites. So the takeaway from the Texas church shooting, as horrible as it may be, is not about guns. It's about these social justice warriors, these lone wolf, radicalized Antifa, who are our real enemies. Are, you know, let me clarify that. They're going to be on the front line fighting the fight of our enemies. And based on what I saw of Devin Patrick Kelly, unless he catches people disarmed, huddled in places of worship, innocent, helpless, they're not much of a threat. When a white man, or in this case two white men, are armed and stand up against them, they get shot and they run off and die. And that's the way all of them will end up. Now, as far as the optics debate, there was a bitter comment that was left on the YouTube video of last week's The Roper Report White Lives Matter podcast. And basically, Stephen on there, I don't know what Stephen's last name is, apparently he doesn't have one, but Stephen said that I should stop being divisive by attacking Andrew Anglin and Richard Spencer, because I said that Richard Spencer is a multimillionaire, and he was the one who pushed for and proposed and started the Unite the Right rally, which led to so many white guys now being in jail, including my friend Jacob Goodwin, and that this multimillionaire, Richard Spencer, has not spent a single penny to help out any of the defendants who are now incarcerated. And that if I was a multimillionaire and was able to spend $10,000 for 2 hours in an auditorium at a university, that I would definitely be contributing more than he has been to help out these arrested white guys. And also said that Andrew Anglin had admitted publicly that he's just a performance artist, and that Andrew Anglin has never, ever attended a single white nationalist rally or protest or demonstration in his life. Never. He doesn't even live in the U.S. and has not lived in our country for years, and he won't suddenly dictate optics to us. Well, Steve responded by saying that I was being divisive. Let me clarify, Stephen. I'm not the one being divisive. When Identity Europa, Nathan D'Amigo, and Andrew Anglin want to say that everyone needs to dress like a refugee from the Gap in their little prancing polos and look like we're a boy band in order to come to demonstration or they shouldn't be allowed, that's being divisive. When these optics cucks say that only people who look like they're wearing a fashy haircut should be allowed to stand up for their people and for free speech and for the 14 words, then they're the ones being divisive. They're the ones being exclusive. They're the ones picking the fight. After all, I'm much more inclusive when it comes to optics than they are. Well, thank you once again for listening to The Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization podcast, brought to you every week here on Radio Aryan. I encourage you to get in touch with the Cover Our People with Love pro-white charity to help out with fabric or with yarn or with financial contributions to help buy them so that we can get this white family drive for 2017's winter exponentially important program going before it's too cold, before it's too late. You can send your tax-deductible contributions to Special Olympics, or to the National Red Cross, or to the March of Dimes. But if you're not concerned about your taxes, if you're more concerned about your people, then you can send those contributions to the Cover Our People with Love pro-white charity at P.O. Box 1937, Mountain View, Arkansas, 72560. And you can find out more about the Shieldwall Network by emailing me, roper_billy@yahoo.com. Check out the Roper Report blog at whitenationalist.com. And until next week, on The Roper Report, Billy's Balkanization Podcast. This is Billy Roper for Radio Aryan, reminding you, as always, to think racially act locally, but no matter what, keep it white.
Can you hear the student band? I think they're getting out of hand. Will you know what happened to those who complain? We've got to stop them seeing light. Let them think it's all right. Do the fire outside to keep them entertained. Well, the wells have not run dry. Do we really need to lie? We'll say it's a national emergency. We're at a wedding full of clowns. I won't kick them while they're down. Get the banks control, cause they are friends to me. Let's go and find a better place. We'll call it New America. Won't it be a lovely place to be? Imperial material, the mind of New America.
Listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.